to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more about the show, you can go to the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all my past shows there. And you can also connect with me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Veronica Roth, internationally best-selling author of the hugely popular Divergent series of novels. Divergent, Insurgent, Allegiant, and also the book Four, a Divergent collection. Divergent received the 2011 Goodreads Choice Award for Favorite Book, Publishers Weekly Best Book of 2011, and was the winner of the Yalsa 2012 Teens Top 10. The Divergent trilogy has been adapted into a blockbuster series of four films starring Shailene Woodley and Theo James, with the final film due out in the spring of 2017. Veronica currently lives with her husband in Chicago. However, she was born in Mount Kisco, New York, after which her family moved to Hong Kong and Germany before settling in Barrington, Illinois. Veronica attended Northwestern University, where she graduated magna cum laude with a degree in English literature with creative writing in 2010. And she wrote the manuscript that would become Divergent in her free time in her senior year. Veronica is a board member of YOLFest, the biggest young adult book festival in the country, and YOLWEST, its sister festival. She's also the co-founder of Headcanon, a podcast that explores the nature of fandom with friend and fellow author Sarah Ennie. The much-anticipated first book in Veronica's next series, a science fiction fantasy duology, is called Carve the Mark and is about to be released. And also for those of you listening in the Santa Cruz area, Veronica is going to be visiting us very soon. Welcome to the show, Veronica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's lovely to have you. You're probably in the midst of an intense book tour right now, are you?
Oh, not yet. I haven't left yet.
Oh, good, good. So it's the calm before the storm then.
Yes.
So I like to start out with my guests and ask them, I'm wondering if you can remember the first time that art of any kind had a deep effect on you, whether it was a book or a picture or music, when you realize that art has a power beyond just entertainment.
Well, I think this probably happened when I was a kid because I was in a special English class in my elementary school for, I don't know, kids who are especially good at English. And we read a lot of books in that class that were really, like, they affected me emotionally to the point where my teacher was a little bit concerned about my well-being and had to talk to my mom. Like, I think Veronica's a little, like, emotionally sensitive. So I don't remember. I remember reading one that in particular was about, like, told from the perspective of, like, lemmings, you know, about, like, the danger of conformity and all those things.
Yes,
and I remember being upset by it.
So kind of poignant example of how art isn't just entertaining necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say, or did you find art for yourself?
No, I, my mother is an artist and my brother is a musician. So I think there's a lot of creative energy in my house growing up. My mom enrolled us all in art classes when we were kids and yeah.
Oh, cool. And you write in the young adult genre. I'm wondering what appeals to you about writing for this age group.
It's kind of an age that I felt really connected to, I think, because it's just so horrible. So the struggles that, like, young adults go through feel particularly poignant and important to me, especially as it's, like, an age group that's constantly underestimated and kind of, I don't know, people are condescending toward teenage girls specifically. So the more I interact with them, the more important it feels to give them as honest a voice as I can.
Yes, yeah. And one could argue that the generations coming up now have kind of pressures and stresses and concerns that perhaps, you know, weren't there in the same way for previous generations, even though some issues obviously are, you know, kind of eternal.
But they do grow up a lot faster now, I think, because of just the internet and social media and just being connected to things in a way that I just couldn't be when I was growing up, and that wasn't even that long ago.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's kind of like you have to almost be or protect your children or keep them from certain information now actively, whereas in the past they wouldn't have even had any access to that information.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Research suggests 55% of young adult books are bought by people 18 and older, and your books are popular with adults too. What do you think it is about them that also attracts an adult readership, do you think?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, I think it's just the stories that people find appealing. They're more prominent. But also there's very little tolerance for, like, slow pacing in young adult books because you're trying to hold the attention of, you know, people are very busy with school and constantly reading for that. And
yes.
So I think that's part of it. I mean,
that's a good point.
They're like really pared down. Compared to adult books, when I read them now, it's they have a little more, like, I don't know, just a higher tolerance for, like, long passages.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it like that. Yeah, yeah. Now, you said you grew up in a creative environment. I'm wondering, when did you first start writing?
I think I first started when I was around 10 or 11. My mother had out loud boredom in her house, like, would not hear it, did not want to hear complaints about boredom. So she got us all these kits, like, you know, there's one where you could build a functioning, like, vehicle, like a car or a boat or whatever, with these globes that have wires running through them. I don't know. It's hard to explain. Uh-huh. They're toys, but they're really fascinating. So we had one of those, and then we had a make your own book kit. And you fill in the pages and then you send it off to this press and they put it together. And that was the first time I had thought, oh, you know, that's a thing that I can do with my time. I can fill a book.
That's interesting because a lot of kids kind of perhaps make, you know, their own little books or whatever. But to send it off and have it come back as a book, that almost is replicating the kind of publishing process, isn't it?
Right. Well, I never actually finished it, funnily enough.
Oh.
I did go to the computer to, like, because I was like, oh, writing by hand is so difficult. Let me just go type on the computer. And that's kind of how it started.
Yeah. Do you remember the first thing that you wrote that you were proud of, you know, that you thought, oh, I might actually have something here?
Oh, man. I feel like I have a lifelong struggle with being very self-deprecating, so I'm not sure that I've ever really been like, yes, this is it.
Okay, so maybe a different question then. What kind of put you on this path then, if you did not feel, you know, completely confident about your work?
Well, in high school, I had a teacher who encouraged me to submit my work to writing contests because he was concerned about my transcript not reflecting how I use my time, you know, because if you spend a lot of your time writing, there's not a whole lot you can show for it when you're applying to colleges.
Oh, right.
So he said, you know, just send it out, like, just send things out and see what you can do. And that's what I did. And it was kind of the first time that anyone had taken my writing seriously because I kind of let him, you know. Some of the contests yielded fruit, so that was good. Yeah.
You've said that you decided at a certain age that you would write for the rest of your life, whether you were published or not. And obviously you've been published at a relatively young age, and so the other scenario is imagined. But what impetus do you think would have kept you writing if you never got published?
I don't know. I think it's really just the joy of doing something that keeps me doing it, you know. So I was never focused on results. I wouldn't describe it as a lifelong dream to have a book published. I didn't think about it that way. I mean, I certainly do think that was a dream, you know, by the time I was submitting my work. But writing to me is very much separate from results. Like it is its own good in my life. It doesn't need to become something in order for me to feel like it's worthwhile.
Interesting. That's probably a good approach. It's probably hard to, I would say almost maybe impossible to make great art if you are thinking about what it's going to do in the world.
Right. And that's a good way to make really preachy art too. Trying to teach people something because you feel like it has to have worth beyond just, you know, being entertaining or the worth that it gives to you. You feel like it has to do something in the world, and so you want to teach people a lesson, which is, like, creepy and weird.
Because it's surreptitious, do you mean? You're sort of preaching through the back door?
Yeah, I mean, I think people ask me what my work says a lot more than they would ask an adult fiction author, because they think because you're writing for children, you're trying to teach the next generation how to live better or how to think. So I think about it a lot, what my responsibility is to my readers. And mostly I think my responsibility is to be honest with them about how people are, even if the world is fantastical. So that's like my only responsibility. I don't think they can't handle things. I'm not here to be condescending. I hope that reading a lot teaches them to think more critically, but that's on them. That's not on me to fix.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And another sort of interesting take on writing for that age group, because I think, you know, obviously writers have themes, and people who write for adult audiences also perhaps have particular things they're interested in. But I guess there might be that extra cultural burden for someone writing for young people, the expectation at least of trying to do a good thing or whatever. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, the internationally best-selling author, Veronica Roth. She's the author of the hugely popular Divergent series of novels. We're going to go to a short break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Danielle and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, internationally best-selling author of the hugely popular Divergent series of novels, Veronica Roth. And Veronica Roth's only Bay Area appearance on her Carve the Mark tour will take place courtesy of Bookshop Santa Cruz, who you heard about in the break there, at Santa Cruz High on January 23rd at 6 p.m. So if you're listening in this area, you will need to get tickets in advance for this event, either from Bookshop Santa Cruz actual store or from bookshopsantacruz.com. And the ticket price includes a signed book and entry into the Superfan Raffle, winners of which will have the chance to meet Veronica after the event. So if you'd like to see Veronica in person, or you know some young adults who would love the opportunity, then put January 23rd, 6 p.m. in your diary, and that's when Veronica will be in Santa Cruz. And remember, tickets from Bookshop Santa Cruz. So Veronica, your latest novel is Carve the Mark. For listeners who haven't read anything about it, it's obviously not out yet, so, you know, can't read it officially, but there has been, you know, stuff online about the story. But for people who don't know, can you give them a brief synopsis without giving too much away?
Sure. So it's set in space, so in a galaxy far, far away, and it's about a young man named Akos who is kidnapped with his brother, and he's taken into this enemy country where he meets the sister of the dictator there, the one who kind of facilitated his kidnapping, and she is, I don't know, kind of difficult to get to know and suffering from constant pain thanks to this ability that she has, and they're trying to figure out if they can help each other or if they're kind of like culturally conditioned hatred is going to win.
After the success of the Divergent series, I imagine you had the chance to pretty much write what you chose. What made you decide to tell the story of Carve the Mark? You know, why this story now?
Well, it's a story I'd been kind of thinking about since I was pretty young. It's a little bit odd to think of like a 12-year-old writing about kidnapping in weird fantasy world, but that's what I was doing. And I kept trying to make the story work over and over again through kind of on and off as I was growing up. And so when it came to picking what I was going to do next after Divergent, I knew I needed something that I really loved. And you know, working on a story that I had tried to write so many times, it felt like a good fit, because clearly I've had interest in it and loved it for long enough that it's not going to like fade away abruptly. So it felt like a safe bet.
Right. So if you'd had that story in your life for so long, how come you wrote the Divergent series before it? Because you couldn't quite get it to work? Or
yeah, it's like this weird internal sense of what the right timing is, you know, like what the story is that feels most urgent to me in the moment. So this one didn't even occur to me. I kind of had to dig it up later to think it through. And Divergent felt like something that I needed to finish at that time.
Right. Yeah. The Divergent series is dystopian science fiction, and Carve the Mark is fantasy science fiction. What appeals to you about writing in these genres rather than writing about the real world?
Well, to me, it's kind of twofold. So on the one hand, I love the escape of it. I love going to other planets and just or to other fantasy worlds. Like, one of my favorite series was, of course, what I was growing up with at the time, which is Harry Potter. And that's a world you just like wish you could be a part of, you know. So when I read those books, even the darker parts are kind of magical and transportive in a lovely way, especially now when things are looking a little bit grim. It's nice to give your brain a little break every now and then. But on the other hand, I really feel like fantasy and science fiction is a way to encounter challenging ideas and to think about things without the added stress of the real world, you know, of it being too real or stressful in that way. Like, you can consider issues that are really important and relevant, but you feel like one step removed from them because you're also, like, there's also magic wands and, you know, like, all kinds of, I mean, there aren't magic wands in Carve the Mark, but you know what I mean? Like, there's this kind of softening effect of setting it in another place, but that doesn't mean the ideas are any less relevant or important to consider.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And also, being able to fix things in a world which maybe aren't as easy or within one's power to fix in this world as well, but to have that sense of
right.
hope or, you know, the means of working through something. Yeah. One thing that really interests me in fiction is archetypes, and which also are a means of kind of working through things in a different way on a more sort of emotional, psychological level. Do you think about your writing at all in that way consciously?
Sometimes, you know, sometimes a character feels more like an idea at first, like something you're trying to play into or subvert in an interesting way. So, like, in young adult books, there's this fairly common trope of, like, a young woman who's kind of used as a weapon by someone else, you know, and that's a trope I find really fascinating and one that I explore with Thyra in Carve the Mark because, I don't know, I just wanted to, I guess, like, explore more of the trauma of that, like, as a young woman being used for what you can give to people as opposed to being seen as a whole person. It felt like, it felt important and urgent.
Yes, yeah. Carve the Mark is told from two perspectives, Thyra in the first person, and is it, how do you pronounce it? Akos? No.
Yes,
is that
yeah,
right?
Akos.
Yeah, great. thank you.
In
the third person. Why did you make these choices of how to tell the story?
Well, I tried to do both in first. So, as usual with my writing, I feel like I just do it the wrong way so many times that I eventually fall on the right way. And so with Akos, I really struggled to find a connection to his character. He was weirdly elusive in a way that I've never had a narrator be while I was writing. And my editor suggested that I give it a try in third person just to kind of give him this separation, almost like he was pushing me out and so I let him. And that's, it just started to work. And interestingly enough, it helped me to figure out his character because he's described as this really wary, guarded figure. And so the voice kind of like creates that separation between reader and character that explains him in a way, like a subtle way that you aren't thinking about directly.
Yeah.
And the two perspectives was also not my plan. So it was originally just Akos' story, but then I needed a Shotet perspective. So the Shotet are the enemies of Akos' people, and Thyra is one of them. And in order to get a more complete view of the world and a more nuanced view of those people, I needed her to tell part of the story, at least.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting, and certainly in this current era, post-truth, which hopefully is temporary, I think seeing, you know, the other side of the story, you know, what the Shotet people think of their history and the difference between that and what Akos thinks is the history, it's pretty revealing, isn't it? You know, whatever the real truth is, you know, what the two sides are, it's interesting to consider that.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that, like, trying to think about something from the perspective of the person who you're assessing would be a revolutionary idea, but these days.
Yes. Yeah, seemingly, yes. In Carve the Mark, the young protagonists are dealing with extraordinarily difficult moral situations and painful occurrences. You've said you think teenagers need stories that speak specifically to young people. How are you hoping your readers will relate the experiences of Thyra and Akos to their own lives?
Well, I touched on it a little bit earlier, but I think Thyra is an especially, I don't know, like a feminine figure to me in the way that I don't always think of my female characters. So she struggles with constant pain. I was reading a lot of articles about how women's pain is underestimated by most doctors, be they female or male. And also a few of my friends were diagnosed after really protracted periods of dealing with like constant pelvic pain with endometriosis. So I don't know. I think women and pain was really on my mind while I was writing about her. And specifically like what I was talking about earlier, being valued for kind of this power that is in her body instead of being valued for her mind or her, or just like her general person. That felt like also like a really relevant struggle to young women.
Yeah.
And so I hope that people connect to that. I mean, there's certainly other things, but when I think about my readers, I kind of like hope that it speaks to them about those issues.
Mm. You have very, you know, strong female characters of all kinds in your books. Do you think of yourself as a feminist? And if you do, what does that mean to you?
I definitely do. And I think it means kind of fighting for equality and also undoing the kind of like toxic masculinity that that harms both men and women. I think feminism is often presented as just like a bunch of women trying to take away what other people have, but that's certainly not it. And it's about kind of like healing our society of this disease of misogyny that affects, you know, everyone.
Yes. Yeah. And I think also for me as a feminist, it's about valuing the feminine and masculine equally, not feeling like women have to become like men to be equal. And I think you do see that quite a lot, that, you know, women are considered equal when they are the CEO, when they're powering through, when they're, you know, the one holding the gun or whatever. And I think obviously if women want to do that, they should. And there's, you know, the need for women to feel empowered. But at the same time, I think it's missing the point if we don't realize that valuing what are traditionally known as feminine aspects, which can also be found in men, you know, is part of the equation. Do you agree with that?
I definitely do, and it's something I think about more and more now that I've written two main characters who are sort of, they're powerful in, like, a lot of stereotypically masculine ways, which I guess is something that I just did naturally because I'm 6 feet tall. I've always been stronger than most women and physically capable, and so it just feels natural to write about characters that are like that, but increasingly, I think it would be more interesting, and certainly I hope to in the future explore kind of more like quintessentially female ways of being powerful, being like emotionally connected, kind of more like finding a lot of value in relationship and then using like those more quiet ways of being strong. I don't know. I mean, we're talking in like generalizations, of course, but it is something that I think about a lot, not trying to make my female characters like men in order to make people feel like they're worthwhile to read about. That's something I'd love to avoid more and more.
Yeah, because, you know, often what you see in literature is the using of female qualities, but, you know, as the power behind the throne or in kind of more cunning ways because they can't use them in a fully, you know, free, powerful way. And so, you know, I think that also is something that would be good to change, you know, because that, again, just keeps women kind of down and those aspects down. In the Divergent series and now with Carve the Mark, you're creating new worlds in which your stories take place. How do you go about achieving a reality of the same intensity as the world that we know and live in?
Well, that was a huge challenge. Like, probably the biggest challenge of this book is just creating a world that felt real and detailed and interesting. So I remember reading a blog post from an author that I know. Her name is Jodi Meadows. And she was writing, I think this is her, I hope I'm not crediting the wrong person. But she was talking about when you're world building, making sure that there are like idiosyncrasies and contradictions and that not everything in your world is built around this one quality or this one thing, which I think occasionally was like one of the bigger world-building flaws in the Divergent series is that this whole culture, you know, this whole subculture is built around one quality and everything is related to that quality.
Mm.
And so with Car the Mark, it was a little more important to me to make sure that there were different kind of sects in each society. There were people who disagreed with each other, people who were religious, who weren't religious, you know, just like all kinds of, like the complexity that we see around us, but, you know, just in a different place based on different things. So that was, it took a lot of doing, a lot of revising.
Right.
I pretty much build as I go. I'm not someone who thinks it all through beforehand. So there were a lot of drafts, let's just put it that way.
I was going to ask you what your process is for writing and completing a book. You know, how do you begin and how do you get to the end, which is, you know, sometimes quite hard, isn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah, I just mess it up repeatedly, really. I mean, I think, I hope that's not as discouraging as it sounds. But yeah, to finish, I mean, I feel like you just have to finish the first time and then you can go back and fix everything you did wrong, but
yeah,
powering through is important at first.
I think that's one thing that perhaps aspiring writers, shall we say, don't realize is how often writers who are published do revise their work. I know I interviewed Rafe Larson and he said he did 200 drafts of his massive novel Radar, and it just sort of is that's
wow.
Just, you know, you're like, oh my goodness, you know, that's overwhelming. But I think that is the art, isn't it? I mean, it's just working on it until you get to the point where it works.
Right. Yeah. And for so many writers, the real work starts when you revise. So for me, the rough draft is just, I mean, it's like a necessary evil. I really wish I didn't have to do it. I hate every minute of it. And then when I'm fixing it, that's when I really feel like I'm getting into the story and I'm experiencing the joy of my work.
Yeah, yeah. When you have a series in mind, do you have the plot line worked out for the whole series in advance?
Usually I have the bigger plot lines figured out and then I'm not quite sure how I'm going to get there, or I'm not sure if it's going to actually feel right when I get there. So I'm like both a planner and not a planner at the same time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, with Divergent, were you sort of thinking, well, the first book has to just stand alone in case I never get the series out there? Or did you just pitch it as, you know, it has to be a series?
No, I definitely tried to make sure that it could stand alone. And looking back, it just doesn't. Like, I don't know why I thought
it's very honest
it would
of
work.
You.
And well, yeah, I mean, as I said, lifelong self-deprecation coming from this direction.
Yeah. Well, maybe,
yeah, I mean,
humility to learn. I mean, because we can all learn forever if we keep open, can't we?
Right. I think it's so important. And also, like, you know, when you have heard as much critique as you do when you have a book out, like, you start to figure out what you agree with and what you don't agree with, you know.
Yes. Yeah, that's a whole other thing, isn't it? Having to be exposed to people's comments on your work. Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to internationally best-selling author Veronica Roth. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
I think that there's more.
It's a question of balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with my special guest from the arts this week, internationally best-selling author of the hugely popular Divergent series, Veronica Roth. And just to remind listeners in the Bay Area, Veronica Roth's only Bay Area appearance on her Carve the Mark tour will take place courtesy of Bookshop Santa Cruz at Santa Cruz High on January 23rd at 6 p.m. And you do need to get tickets in advance for that. You can get them either from Bookshop Santa Cruz, the physical store, or from bookshopsantacruz.com. So again, Veronica will be in the Bay Area January 23rd at 6 p.m. in Santa Cruz. So put that in your diaries. So, Veronica, your stories are violent and brutal at times. In your new book, Carve the Mark, there's torture and murder, for example. I'm wondering what your feelings are about the place for violence in your books.
Well, I try to think about it deeply. So, I kind of started out just kind of, I mean, I love action movies, so I love, like, that kind of heart-racing, intense stuff. But life is not an action movie, so you have to be careful about the way you're describing brutality and violence, making sure that it has like relevance to the story, that it is important in some way. Like it would be a lie to pretend that those horrible things don't happen and that they aren't, you know, one of the primary reasons why our world is difficult to live in and why it requires people to fight for good. And you need that contrast in order to show hope and productivity over those things and kind of triumph, you know, those like heightened positives. Things.
Yes. Yeah.
And so for me, it's a lot of like, I don't know, encouraging characters to grow, and to rise to challenges and also to establish like why these things need to be fought, you know, because they're horrible.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Writing for the young adult market, obviously romance and sex loom large as concerns. What's important for you and how you convey the intimate relationships in your books?
Well, I think for me, it's just what you said. It's just about intimacy. So, you know, I'm not here to write explicit things just because, especially, you know, when you're writing for young people, there's something like very odd about that. You want to be careful with the physical parts of a relationship, just as you're careful with the violence. Like you have to be careful about what you're including and make sure that it's relevant. So for me, that kind of like the romance part is about showing the connection between two people. And that's about it. I mean, my understanding of it kind of changes depending on the story, like what's necessary to be in there and to show character growth.
Right. Yes, yeah. There's a psychologist, Alice Miller, who I love, and she writes at length about how art can help people process difficult events. She studied a lot of artists like Picasso and lots of other people, and she felt that art had the potential to help heal trauma, whether that trauma was personally experienced or from events that had been witnessed. And I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect both on those making the art and also those experiencing it.
Well, I certainly hope so. you know, I'm always a bit cynical. I do think we think of its healing qualities kind of in an incomplete way a lot of the time. So part of healing is fully acknowledging trauma, you know, to the degree that it affected a person. And so I think the temptation is to kind of gloss over the trauma part and skip to the healing, but you can't do that. You have to really engage with pain and with difficulty in order to kind of come back from all of it, I guess.
Yes.
Sort of like sucking the poison out of a snake bite or something, which I guess, I don't, do people do that? I don't know. Just in movies. But yeah, I mean, I do think art can be a helpful means of expression for people who have gone through really painful things. And also, like, culturally, we have to engage with particular things in order to kind of excise them.
Yes. I mean, I think you're right. It's not simply enough to express something, to bring something into consciousness. One also then has to work with that and continue the process through, because otherwise you just become stuck in, you know, the experience of the trauma over and over again. Kandinsky said there is no must in art because art is free. And in the purest sense of art, this is true, but pursued as a commercial venture, there can be a tension between what might be commercially viable and what the artist wants to achieve in a pure sense. And so I'm wondering whether you feel that tension at all in your work, whether you have an eye to what will be popular, or perhaps whether commerciality and art don't need to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I think one thing I've kind of struggled to accept coming from the kind of more, I guess, adult literary writing background that I did in college is that I just have very commercial tastes. Like I said before, I love action movies.
Right.
I'm really into superheroes. Like I'm just, you know, I'm not like terribly sophisticated in the things that I like to consume a lot of the time. I mean, I would argue that there's a lot of value in them and depth too. But I guess I don't think about it so much because it's just something that comes naturally. I kind of have to think the other way, like maybe don't make the most obvious choice at this point. Maybe don't hit the reader over the head with something quite as hard as your first instinct might direct you. You know, like that's kind of something I'm working against to become better and more nuanced in my characters and in my you know, just prose on a very basic level. So I'm kind of working, I guess, against the commercialness of that comes naturally to me, where I feel like other people maybe are trying to bring out more commerce because they're just trying to make a living, you know?
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's can be an intellectual snobbery around, you know, what subjects, you know, might be suitable for art and perhaps particularly in the genre you're writing in. But I think, you know, for me, you know, anything is up for grabs with art. I mean, it's then what you do with it, you know. So with the internet and social media, there's a sense of increasing self-consciousness as we consider what effect whatever we put on the internet has on others, to the extent that it's really made me wonder how much we're living our lives versus performing them. And with your blog and a major online presence due to your success, I'm wondering if you feel like you're performing your life at all, and if you're able to switch off from the sense of there being an audience in your personal life.
Sometimes I do catch myself kind of like almost living experiences in order to take a selfie with them, which is very disturbing to me. And one of the things that is like on the forefront of my mind these days, just because I find myself like becoming addicted to technology, to Twitter, to Instagram, to all those things. And sometimes I think they're perfectly fine and innocuous, and they can be a way of connecting to people that you wouldn't ordinarily be exposed to. So there's definitely benefits to social media. And, you know, I get my news like instantaneously on Twitter, you know, as events are happening, which is really amazing.
Yes.
But yeah, I do try to shut it off. Like if I'm traveling for work, then I'll take pictures. I'll live my life on the internet because it's part of my job. But when I go on like family vacation, I'm not taking pictures of that. So trying to have experiences.
Yeah. It's so pervasive though. I mean, everywhere you go now, I really, you see people by the beach and they're just doing something jolly. And then the next thing, the phone's whipped out and there's a photo of it, and or someone's FaceTiming with people, someone remotely. And yeah, it's just a challenge, I think, which is, I don't know how it's being met currently, really, to really still live, you know, and not just be constantly have this eye to an audience, even if you're not famous. I mean, it must be 1,000 times worse for you if being famous, you know, but even for, you know, just people in regular life. Yeah.
Well, my strategy, the only one I've found that really helps, is just to create boundaries in yourself between things that are like okay to share and things that are not. So, you know, in my own life, like I'll show pictures of breakfast and my dog, but I will not show pictures of my husband. You know, so sort of like those like things I want to reserve just for myself and for the actual living of my life. So it's weird to have to like create those boxes to put your life in. but I do think it's helpful. Like, oh, this is not a social media occasion. Like, I will leave my phone in my purse or at home even.
Yeah. Yeah, that whole switching off the phone thing seems to be a major challenge, doesn't it, these days?
It's like turning off a heartbeat.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like what if there's an emergency? Like, I don't know. What did people do about emergencies before we all had cell phones?
I know, exactly. Or what if so-and-so can't get hold of me? It's like, well, you know, what happened before?
Exactly.
Somehow the world survived for thousands of years. Yeah, it is a strange phenomenon, that's for sure. I think All Out is about communication, and Degas said, art is not what you see, but what you make others see. And I'm wondering what you hope others see in your work. I know you said you don't like preachy writing, but is there an overarching theme in your writing, or are you really just thinking about stories?
Well, I'm working through a thought with my writing, which is that telling a specific story about a specific person is universal in a way that I don't know that we always think of it. You know, like it's the specific story and the details that people connect to, not some broad thing. So I think people don't think their stories are worth telling because they don't feel important or big in that way. Mm. But really, like the specific story is what's important. It's the only thing that is universal, sort of. You know, the experience might not be, but like your humanity is, you know. So I guess, I mean, I'm sure there are like recurring themes in my work that are just like oozing out of me, almost like unwittingly, but I really do try to focus on the specific character, the specific voice in that specific situation, which it just happens to be in space.
Yeah. Creative writing and fiction reading are being somewhat usurped in the new school curriculum, at least in California, by so-called practical reading and analytical writing. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the necessity for our children to have fiction reading and writing as part of their education.
Oh, well, clearly I'm biased. I'd be out of a job if we all stopped reading fiction. But I started doing this because I found it so important to read made-up stories, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they, on one level, kind of like foster empathy. And you can't just force people to feel empathy. You have to tell them a story. Like, we make sense of the world around us through narrative. So we have to practice reading it and thinking critically about it and the truths that it communicates to us. So to me, cutting that out entirely is just cutting off one of the most important qualities that we are tasked to develop in our young people, which is empathy. And the less we have in the world, the more horrible the world becomes. So, like, please read books.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think also the development of abstract thought is really important, because that's how you get to a place of empathy. You know, you have to be able to put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. And I remember reading a long time ago, you know, some research that said if children didn't develop abstract thought by the age of 7, then they probably never would, you know. And that's really kind of a scary thought in a lot of ways, because I think increasingly, as you mentioned, it's really important that we see other people's perspectives and take them into account.
Yes.
Yeah.
I am also now alarmed by that. Pre-7-year-olds. They need good teachers.
Yes, and I guess good parenting. More pressure on us parents to do the right thing. But I do think that, you know, there's the whole thing of developing the imagination. You know, I think having everything provided for you in the form of digital media doesn't develop imagination in the same way as reading and imagining, you know, making up games and things like that. So I do think it's important that we try and keep that in our children's lives, definitely. And
yes, I would be so depressed if I one day have a child and they're not really excited about empty cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, all I wanted was my parents to buy a new refrigerator so that I would get the biggest cardboard box possible. I don't know where this came from. But, you know, there was really no toy better than just, like, something that is completely open to you just imagining it. It could be a vehicle. It can be, like, Calvin and Hobbes style, like a transmogrifier or whatever he makes cardboard boxes into, a cloning machine or whatever. Like, it's just, I don't know. That's, like, how I started writing. You know, when I was a kid, before I wrote things down, is I would just go out and imagine these, like, elaborate kind of games with the neighborhood kids, and, you know, we'd pretend for hours. I don't know. I mean, just, like, a childhood without that feels kind of sad.
Yeah. So I do think that's important to keep an eye to, but certainly the kind of work you're doing, I think, is stimulating that area of people's brains. So you're doing your part.
I hope so.
So we've come to the end of the show. Thank you so much for coming on, and wish you all the best on your tour for Carve the Mark. Where do you start?
I start in New York.
Right, yeah. Well, we're looking forward to having you in this area of the world, in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'm so excited to come. I've never been to Santa Cruz.
So. Oh, really? It's an interesting place, definitely.
Yeah.
So we'll be very happy to have you. And just want to remind listeners again who are in this area. If you're not in this area, then I'm sure if you go to Veronica's website, veronicarothbooks.com, you'll be able to find out information about other cities that she's coming to. But if you are in the Bay Area, she's going to be at Santa Cruz High on January the 23rd at 6 p.m. And just to remind you that you do need to get tickets in advance for that. So that's, again, January the 23rd. Via Bookshop Santa Cruz at Santa Cruz High. Well, thanks again so much, Veronica, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, me too.